Davis and Opdorp here with Matt Ford and Jonathan Harding. There is a title race in the Bundesliga after Borussia Dortmund drew over the weekend and Bayern Munich won their game against Schalke. We're going to talk about both of those results, and Felix was in Bremen for the 120th birthday of Werder Bremen Sport Club. But first, let's start in Dortmund. So a very rough week for Borussia Dortmund. They lost to Werder Bremen in the German Cup in penalties. And they also blew a 3-0 lead against Hoffenheim. Jonathan, you were following that game pretty closely. When they were 3-0 up, it seemed like they were in complete control. And then all of a sudden, they just took their foot off the gas and then just couldn't find their mojo again.
I mean, they were in complete control, but I don't know whether it was a case of taking their foot off the gas and more a case of just making basic errors. I mean, now, this is what's perhaps alarming, and I wrote about it afterwards. You know, lots of people saying Dortmund's defence has been pretty good this season, and it has, and in some respects it's been a bit of a patchwork defence because they've had players out injured. But the manner of the goals they conceded against Hoffenheim is what concerns me most. I mean, if they'd conceded three goals on the counter-attack, you know, from stupidly well-executed transitional plays by a Julian Nagelsmann side, I would have been less concerned, because those are the kind of things that can happen, and Borussia Dortmund do play in a way that allows the opposition to get in behind them. But this was a case of Dortmund making three isolated mistakes that led to goals that would have been scored by many teams, not just Hoffenheim. Okay, we look at it from goal to goal. The first goal, the cross comes in, Diallo doesn't clear it. We can argue that his positioning isn't great, but the cross isn't hit with such speed that he has no time to react. He has more than enough time to clear the ball, even if it's just out for a corner. You may say that Roman Bürki should probably do better, but I think that's the second level of critique. The first level is that Diallo should just stop the cross, priority number one. The second goal, Hakimi doesn't even make an attempt to jump for the header. And we come to a whole conversation, and you could do a whole podcast on Hakimi. His upside is that he's a winger. His downside is that he's not a defender. And Dortmund play in a way that allows his attacking qualities to shine very often. But when his defensive deficits are shown, they are shown glaringly. And this is the case. And the third goal, what's interesting as well about the third goal is that in the highlight package, you don't see the real reason for the goal. The real reason for the goal is that Jadon Sancho commits a needless foul just outside the penalty area because he's frustrated, because his side are losing despite him playing really well. But it's a classic case of an attacker getting involved in a situation he doesn't need to be in. Then in the free kick, Dortmund don't sit deep enough and get behind the ball. Try to play an offside trap, which I think is perhaps a little bit dangerous with 3 minutes to go. And whoever's marking Belfodil isn't marking him. Granted, it's a great diving header. But all three situations are preventable. And I don't want to sound like I'm being overly harsh on a Dortmund defence, as I say, that has been pretty good this season, all things considered. But this is the worst possible time to do that. It opens the door for Bayern Munich. It opens the door for mental concern going into a European week at the hardest time of the season. You hit February, the fixtures come thick and fast now. And make no mistake, this is a psychological blow to this Dortmund team.
Was this draw, Matt, a really one that we're going to look back on and say, if Dortmund don't win the title, are we going to look back? This is going to be one of the results we look back and say, they probably should have gotten 3 points, and that would have made the difference.
If they don't go on to win the title, yeah, I think it is a game we'll look back on. I think what's interesting, though, is that some of the things that went wrong for Dortmund, not just the Hoffenheim game, but also looking at Bremen and also the draw against Frankfurt before that, quite a few issues have come home to roost that people around Borussia Dortmund have actually mentioned and spoken about in recent weeks. Picking up, first of all, from what John was saying about Sancho and Hakimi from a defensive point of view, Sebastian Kehl said after the game against Hanover that, yeah, they're absolutely delighted with Hakimi's development, but they're well aware that there are issues there defensively. I think he was referring more to Hakimi's positioning, his tactical awareness, but I think equally the same can be said about the fact that he didn't get up for that header. Was that for the first or the second goal? That was the second.
That was the second goal.
So yeah, I mean that's something that obviously Dortmund are aware of, and it's come home to roost. I would suggest that again the same applies to Jadon Sancho. He's written more than enough headlines this season. He's got absolutely nothing to prove in terms of his quality. His control, his dribbling skills and his shooting ability going forward. His finish was reminiscent of the finish against Gladbach, wasn't it? The
way
he's gone that diagonal run and then cut the ball across without even looking at where he's putting the ball. Outstanding. We all know that. But as John rightly pointed out, going back, he's committed a needless foul and put his team needlessly under pressure. Is that something that Dortmund are aware of? Yeah, probably. Is it something that Sancho will have to learn as he gets older and develops? Yeah, definitely. So those issues had been spoken about. Another issue that came out following the 5-1 win against Hanover, Roman Bürki conceded in the final minute, in the closing minutes of that game.
Furious.
They were already 5-0 up, and yet it was him who came storming into the mix zone after that game. And while a lot of the Dortmund players were like quite quickly hushed past the journalists into the dressing room, Bürki made a beeline to some of the more well-known faces in around Borussia Dortmund and, laid into his teammates. He was absolutely fuming that they'd conceded that goal, and the word he used was arrogance. And now, that's his word, not mine, but I think it does give a little bit of food for thought with Borussia Dortmund. Just to think, we have started the season so well. There's so many positive things about Borussia Dortmund, but let's not get too carried away, especially defensively, going to the most important part of the season. Because ironically, defensively is probably one of the biggest things we were praising Lucien Favre for at the very start of the season, saying this is what needs sorting out with Borussia Dortmund. And Favre did that. Obviously, since the Gladbach game, I think, before Christmas, Julian Weigl's been filling in at the back.
He's done a decent job.
He has done a decent job, although I'm surprised that Gladbach game didn't finish 4-0.
Yeah.
Even Gladbach were missing their centre-backs as well, weren't they?
Yeah.
The absence of Akanji, the absence of Zagadou. Yeah. It's clearly being shown.
Yeah, both Akanji and Zagadou are missing. So it's not only that Weigl has to play centre-back, but it also means that Abdou Diallo, whose mistakes you mentioned already, Jonathan, he has to play next to Weigl. Mm. And there are times when Lucien Favre would put him out on the wing instead of having him in the centre, because he felt more comfortable putting him out on the left.
Well, if you play him on the left, then you obviously get the defensive upside that you don't get if you play Hakimi, right?
Right.
So it makes sense. But my concern is that I think Zagadou is capable of making the same mistakes. Because if you remember, it was Zagadou that never jumped with Naldo for that 4-4 against Schalke, right? So we know that he's capable.
Dortmund have form for giving away big leads at home, don't they?
They do. And he's capable of he can make the same error as well. So I think it's only Akanji, who I think has been sensational, is the real missing piece. So I think it's less a case of, maybe if we had him, it would be easier. Favre would certainly have more options to choose from, which would make life easier for him. But these are issues that come from a lack of individual responsibility in those situations. And it doesn't matter who it is, because Dortmund need to get things right. And I think what the most interesting part of the Hanover game, most of the games in the last few weeks of Borussia Dortmund that no one is talking about, is how amazing Roman Bürki has been.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that's interesting.
Not just as a goalkeeper, but also as a leader, as
absolutely.
You guys mentioned.
Although, John, was he not culpable for that first Hoffenheim goal? He gets a good hand to it and it ends up still going behind the line.
Yeah, and you could argue that he should do better there, but I would like to protect the keeper in this aspect because I really think the defender needs to give his keeper more of a hand. And, earlier on in the game, he makes a brilliant save to deny Joel Linton, and then later on in the game, he makes an amazing save to tonight, I think it's Kadarabek again. He makes a number of great saves. And it looks a bit scrappy and it's a bit unfortunate, and you can definitely critique him for the goal. But given his form of late, he must be so frustrated that the form he's delivering.
Form of his life.
Really the best form of his career, which is even more impressive given the critique he had last season, is not being assisted by the four men in front of him. And I know that Dortmund fans will say, well, but for most of the season it's been good. Yeah, that's true. No one's discounting that. But if there was ever a time not to deliver this kind of performance, it was now. You don't concede three goals in the last 25 minutes of a game that you, as you rightly said, are in complete control of. And arrogance is probably a good word, because maybe subconsciously there was a feeling of, we're 3-0 up, we've got one of the most exciting teenagers in Europe on our team, Marco Reus isn't here, Lucien Favre isn't here, but it doesn't matter. And that was the mistake they seem to have made.
Yeah, do you think that Lucien Favre's absence played a role? Because he, I mean, you saw also just in some of the substitution patterns, taking off Mario Götze, who I thought was having a terrific game. Maybe he was gassed at that point, but you bring on Omar Toprak in his place. And maybe that's a decision that Lucien Favre wouldn't make. He'd do something maybe more clever in bringing on Jakob Brun-Larsen or maybe Marius Wolf at that point.
I think it did play a role, but I think not necessarily in terms of attacking substitutions like the ones you're suggesting with Brun-Larsen or Wolf, but more on the fact that one of the things that stood out in terms of Lucien Favre's approach to training and early training sessions at the start of the season when he first took over the team was his meticulous approach to the defensive work. And I think although we've talked a lot about how good Zagadou and Akanji have been alongside Diallo and how having the issue of having Weigl there has not been perfect, that's an issue. We've talked about the issue Dortmund have had I've had up front potentially not taking all of the chances. However, I want to put a word in for Thomas Delaney in midfield as well, and in doing so steal shamelessly a brilliant stat which I found in Kicker earlier this morning. Obviously Delaney missed the game, I think through suspension, wasn't it? Against Hoffenheim.
Mamou Daoud was playing in his place.
Indeed. Yeah. In the games in which Delaney has started, Dortmund have been going 125 minutes before conceding each goal. However, in the games he's not played, that's where they concede a goal every 43 minutes. And in the games which he's missed altogether, not even come off the bench, that's Augsburg 4-3, Hertha 2-2, and the Hoffenheim game, they've been conceding goals every 34 minutes. So it just goes to show that despite the progress made at the back, at least in the first half of the season, and despite the headlines being written by Götze, Reus and Sancho, Thomas Delaney has been silent but absolutely
pivotal.
Interesting
how that
in
role
for the pack.
That role there.
I was going to say this: how that system works with Delaney.
Yeah, because Witzel is a different player when Delaney's there because he's allowed to be. And then you obviously look at that stat, and then you rewatch or rethink about the game against Hoffenheim, and Dahoud is culpable in those situations because he's not providing the same cover. Delaney's the kind of guy who would just throw himself around.
With Dahoud there, it usually seemed to be Witzel who was forced back into that more conservative holding role. And he's already proven this season he's better having Delaney as the foil behind him.
But it still doesn't, for me, excuse the defensive display.
No, it doesn't, not at all. But it can't help not having those two in front of them, especially when your defence is all over the place unsettled anyway.
So all these problems set the stage for a pivotal Champions League tie with Tottenham Hotspur on Wednesday. Dortmund is the first team, the German team, that's going to be appearing in the last 16. And Tottenham Hotspur, they're missing Harry Kane and they're... who else are they missing?
Dele
Alli. Dele
Alli is also out,
And they've... But as you mentioned off-air, Jonathan, they still have been in form despite missing those two key players. Is this past week for Dortmund, considering their last three results, does this give you a much more pause now when it comes to their Champions League campaign?
It's tricky. I mean, it's hard not to have some sense of a pause after the Hoffenheim game because that performance was really rather disappointing. And I think more than anything, irrespective of how you analyse that performance, it was quite clearly a psychological blow. Like I think the key aspect of judging how Borussia Dortmund will play against Tottenham Hotspur will be whether or not they have psychologically overcome that draw against Hoffenheim, because that felt like a defeat. Now, it's all well and good if you read players' Instagrams. It sounds like, tough defeat, but we move on. The usual blurb, and it sounds like that's fine, but there's a different process mentally to go through and privately than there is publicly, and I hope that Borussia Dortmund can do that. Now, I really do think, what role is Marco Reus going to play in this? Because it's unlikely that he's going to play if all reports are true, and quite honestly, looking at the way that his injury pattern has changed over the last month, I'd say it's pretty unlikely that he's going to play in this game. I'd be very surprised if he does. If he does, he won't be 100%. So what role is he going to take as the captain, as the leader of this team, even though he's not going to play, in getting this team right mentally for this game? Because I think in a lot of ties this season, the way the draw has gone, I think particularly for the German clubs, maybe it sounds a bit cliche to say, but I think the first leg is very, very important.
Yeah.
And Tottenham...
Which is why I think it's also, I think it's a little overrated to play the first leg away from home.
Yes, but
which
I mean,
is another discussion, but...
Yeah, but I mean, Dortmund know that they have to... I mean, they're going to Wembley and they know that the way the outcome of this game is important for so many reasons, but if not mainly, so that they still have a chance when Marco Reus is fit for the second leg. I think that's kind of... And it's at home in Dortmund, all of those things, you bring that together. So I don't know whether I have more pause, but I think this game now feels even more defining for Dortmund's season.
Do you think, Matt, do you think that this they still have a good chance of winning this game without Marco Reus and given their recent form?
I'm not sure if the absence of Marco Reus is the absolute be-all and end-all. Huge loss, of course, not just in terms of his footballing ability, but in terms of the talismanic captain that he is. I think the bigger issue is the fact that this is a young squad coming off the back of three disappointing results. I think the first time they've gone three games without a win all season. Defensive frailties, which they knew about, being so brutally exposed. Midfield issues as well coming to the fore, and perhaps psychological issues in terms of Avigan's all coming to the fore. I think that's going to have the bigger effect, and I think it's going to give them concerns going into the game at Wembley. Concerns that they wouldn't have had before the Dusseldorf game. So going into the end of the first half of the season, where I thought looking at that, I think even at that point we were looking at Dele Alli already being out at that point, weren't we? Even that far back. I think I might have even said on here, I think looking at it, it looked like one of the most exciting draws in the Champions League. With two attacking teams going for it, and I would have, it was hard to call, but I wouldn't have bet against Dortmund getting the best of Tottenham over two legs. This time I think they've got a huge psychological barrier to overcome.
Well, I mean,
They went to Wembley last season, admittedly. It's slightly different personnel. Went behind, equalised before then getting pretty much rolled over, and then they lost again to Tottenham in the return game. I think there'll be a psychological issue to overcome there, especially defensively, unless Favre can, use the few days he's got in preparation to really go back to the basics which he managed to instil in them so quickly and so well when he first took charge.
And it depends how he wants to play it, you know. I mean, obviously he's going to be limited by some of the options, but defensively, how he sets up will be a huge indication of how he wants to play. If he moves Diallo left, brings Zagadou in the middle with Weigl, then he's obviously not looking to bomb down the left in the same way as he would if Hakimi was playing. And maybe that's the wiser way to go against Tottenham away from home. But then on the other hand, you could argue the case the other way and say, well, you need an away goal. So play Hakimi, run the risk of conceding, because if you want to concede, if you have to concede, you might as well concede in London and come away from that with a 2-2 draw or something, you know. And there's an upside to both. But I think however he decides to set up will be a huge indication of his game plan.
Yeah, coming away from London with even a 2-1 defeat, a goal will be vital. And obviously they're well capable of that. But I really do, given three goals shipped at home against Bremen and 4 days later against Hoffenheim. Some of the naivety defensively displayed by particularly Sancho and Ashraf Hakimi, I'd be slightly concerned now for them.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about the Bremen game. I mean, I know that that's a few days ago, but the goals, you know, some of those situations are equally worthy of damning assessment. And I think that's a concern. So if Dortmund can get over that psychological hump, then they'll stand a good chance.
So Borussia Dortmund's draw against Hoffenheim opened the door for Bayern Munich to cut their gap in the title race to 5 points. They're back in second place after spending last weekend in third place. And they looked like the impressive Bayern Munich team that we know from the past few seasons against Schalke. We can talk about Schalke's credentials at this point in the season at some point, but Jonathan, Serge Gnabry and Kingsley Coman played in this game, and they looked really good.
Yeah, difference makers, absolutely. And I think it's interesting. I think I talked about it, or I mentioned it on Twitter, actually. I think Serge Gnabry is as important for Bayern Munich as Marco Reus is for
Borussia. Yeah, you said that in the cup game.
I think it's true again on the weekend. I think he's proved himself. And I think the really funny part about that is I think he's also just as important for Germany. And I think that says an awful lot about the direction that modern football has gone in terms of how important having an attacker who is quick but also strong and technically gifted is for the way that football was played in 2019. But it also says a lot about the direction that all three of those teams, and I count Dortmund in this conversation with Reus, about how they play football and how they're moving forward. And it says a lot about Serge Gnabry's development as well, because this is a guy who I don't think many people a few years ago would have believed if you'd have said in 2019 he'll be the most important player of Bayern Munich's attack. Yes, Lewandowski scores a lot of goals and is very talented, but I think Serge Gnabry does something for this team that no one else does. And I think that was evident again on the weekend. I think Schalke had their moments, and this game might have gone another way if they were a better team at the moment, but they're just playing poor football. But Bayern Munich got the win they needed. They looked sublime at times, but I would say that defensively there are some concerns there. And I think this is a point that echoes through all three German sides in the knockouts of the Champions League: Schalke, Dortmund, Bayern Munich. All three of them look quite concerningly frail when it comes to defending, in a way that I think their opponents can also, rather alarmingly, ruthlessly exploit. Manchester City demonstrated they flexed their muscles on the weekend against Chelsea. I think they will look at Schalke's backline with delight. Bayern Munich are playing Liverpool. Liverpool are a side who are capable of destroying teams with their attack.
Pressing too. Yeah, attack.
Yeah, and Bayern Munich succumbed to that. You know, if Bayern Munich conceded three goals to Fortuna Düsseldorf earlier this season because of basic long ball to the quick striker routine, which is also how Schalke scored their goal, basically on a textbook counter-attack, but it was the same kind of principle, then that's concerning. And Niko Kovac, I mean, I think he's doing a great job, all things considered, but he has to make some really big decisions. And I thought for this game, it was really strange that he didn't drop Mats Hummels after Mats Hummels' performance in the Cup, which I thought was worthy of being dropped, and he dropped Niklas Süle. And I thought it was really strange that he decided to drop Goretzka in midfield so that Hammers could play farther forward, even though Leon Goretzka's been the form of his life, basically, since playing in the 10. Whether this is part of his keep everybody happy rotation thing that he's been talking about, I don't know. But he's got some big decisions to make. He got it right on Saturday. They won the game. The gap is reduced. We can all get excited about how close it is. And it is close because Dortmund wobbling, this does make things interesting. But Bayern have just the same weaknesses, I think, as Dortmund do. And I think some of those were exposed against Schalke.
Well, it's interesting. Matt, you and I had a good discussion about the Hoffenheim game to start the Rückrunde with Bayern Munich. And that we mentioned that Javi Martinez in midfield and having Leon Goretzka at the 10 really made a difference. But that hasn't been the case the last few weeks. Thiago has been playing in that number 6 role. And James Rodriguez and Leon Goretzka have been playing in midfield together. Does this team still need a number 6? One of the more traditional number 6s? A guy that's more defensive?
But it's funny because Kovac said before the Schalke game that he took Martinez out because when Martinez was playing, they didn't have any attacking play.
And I think that made sense against a Schalke team.
Sure.
It's a weird one.
But
I think
drop Goretzka for that? That's my issue. Do you know? Like, I thought James was great, but do you move someone who's in form to accommodate removing Martinez and playing Thiago? That's why I didn't understand.
This is what it's all about, getting the balance right for Kovac. You talked about before with the defensive changes down to him. Was it a specific reaction to Schalke? I don't think it was. I think it was more to do with keeping a big squad happy. I think the same can be applied to the midfield as well. I don't think it made a huge... I don't think it was too detrimental, not against Schalke anyway, to move Goretzka out of position. Hammers played really well as well when he came in. Goretzka didn't have the worst game. I think that worked partly, not necessarily by design, but partly because Schalke's midfield allowed it to. I think this is actually a bit ironic as well. I thought Weston McKennie played extremely well for Schalke.
He did.
But he was playing in that role where he probably shouldn't have been playing so well so far up, because he was meant to be holding alongside Sebastian Rudi.
Who had a terrible game.
And probably needed a more stable, a second number six alongside him. So I think the fact that, I think in a weird way, the fact that Schalke and Domenico Tedesco made some quite positive changes, and they actually came off in terms of McKennie's performance, and we'll get onto Ahmed Katoucho up front as well in a second, though in paying off, they opened up enough room in midfield for Niko Kovac's own changes, which were made for different reasons, to also not be detrimental. So I think Kovac maybe got a little bit fortunate there in terms of Schalke changes playing into their hands as well.
Yeah. Before we move on to Schalke, I wanted to go into this this altercation between Didi Hamann, who works. Former midfielder who works for Sky Sports, and Robert Lewandowski and Hasan Salihamidzic. So Didi Hamann said at last week that Robert Lewandowski was a danger to the Bayern dressing room. To which Hasan Salihamidzic said, "Well, I think that Didi Hamann is a danger to Sky Sports." And there was this tit for tat going back and forth, and it was also, and you could tell that what Didi Hamann said resonated with Bayern Munich, because guess who was wearing the captain's armband on Saturday? It was Robert Lewandowski, which I think everybody who was following that did not see as a coincidence. I mean, this is the same crap that we saw earlier in the season, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, also Salihamidzic saying afterwards that Didi Hamann, what he's saying is a campaign against Lewandowski, is just a continuation of Bayern Munich being unable to take criticism. And it's quite concerning that in an age where there's a lot of questions about how media is being delivered news, that Bayern are now trying to control their own narrative and being very public about it. I think that's very concerning, and I think it's very wrong. Didi Hamann is allowed to have his own opinion. As far as I'm concerned, he has more than enough experience to have that opinion. He's in a position where, my experience, he has delivered that opinion fairly soundly on a regular basis. And if there's an issue with him saying he thinks that Lewandowski is a problem because he's a want-away striker who obviously has quality, which he's mentioned a number of times, but that might be a little bit disrupting for a Bayern Munich dressing room. If Bayern Munich have issue with that, then Bayern Munich probably have issue with everything that everybody has ever said about Bayern Munich, because there's enough criticism going around. And for them to ruffle their feathers in this way quite publicly, I think it was Rummenigge who said afterwards, when he was asked about it, "I don't even have any response to justify that. Like, I can't justify a response to that." It baffles me, but it is a continuation of the press conference that we saw earlier in the season that was, well, this is, you know, all of the things said about Neuer, about the continuation. It seems like a club that isn't aware of what it's doing. Or if it is, that's even more alarming. But it's embarrassing. I would be embarrassed if I was a Bayern Munich fan, because I think he's entitled to his opinion, and the reaction suggests Salihamidzic isn't necessarily doing the best in handling that job.
I don't think he is. I think this whole affair, especially regarding Lewandowski, says a lot more about Hasan Salihamidzic and Bayern Munich than it does about either Lewandowski or Didi Hamann.
Yeah.
I think going back to the press conference that you mentioned, John, that was very much as it was quite unpalatable, it was very much from the heart of Bayern Munich, unfortunately. You could tell it was something that actually came very natural to Uli Hoeneß and to a lesser degree Karl-Heinz Rummenigge to come up with this natural almost hatred and dismissal of independent reporting about the club, which is worrying in itself. What Salihamidzic has done with the comments that he's come out with regarding this Lewandowski-Didi Hamann affair is almost in a sort of manufactured and artificial way try to tag himself onto that whole dynamic, as if to say to his bosses in Hoeneß and Rummenigge,
look, I can do it too.
Yeah. I'm on your side. I'm part of the Bayern family. I can do Mia San Mia and all that as well. Yeah. Everyone back to the wall, circle the wagons, we're Bayern Munich and blah, blah, blah. And it's not come across right. I think he's missed the point entirely, coming out with petty comments. Oh, I think you're more dangerous to Sky Sports. I mean, for God's sake, what are we talking about here? Not even sure what you're trying to get at with that.
We're talking about a man who has an opinion on something about a footballer end of the day.
And I don't think it would bother. It's not going to bother Robert Lewandowski one little bit.
He doesn't care.
He came out with one quote in the week, didn't he? He said, oh, I don't really care what Hamann says.
Yeah.
It's nonsense. He's got no idea about tactics, whatever. Standard response from any footballer under pressure. Lewandowski has got nothing to prove. Equally, I don't think Hamann needs to defend his opinions that much. I think you can quite rightly argue from Hamann's point of view, a player who is so independent and arguably once away as Lewandowski, which can so often be a positive for Lewandowski as well. The fact that he's selfish and he's his own man, and by all accounts, he's not the most amicable and communicative and social player in the Bayern Munich dressing room. But it's not necessarily a problem.
Name me a great striker that ever has been.
Exactly. It doesn't bother him. I don't think Hamann was wrong to point out that may be an issue in a dressing room where Niko Kovac, as a new, relatively experienced coach, is trying to assert his authority. I mean, that's a fair opinion to have. For Salihamidzic, it's then to go and pretend that he's got some big problem because he wants to impress his bosses. I think it's just, the latest in quite a few pathetic episodes.
He can't keep the job at the end of the season. And if he does, it just suggests to me that Bayern are walking blindly down a path that is just alarming.
Well, I'm also wondering too, do you think this were Salihamidzic's sentiments, or do you think that there was also a mixture of Hoeneß and Rummenigge trying to come out of his mouth as well?
Maybe, but I agree with Matt. I think it's more a case of an eager school kid trying to win awards or trying to win prize with the president, you know, trying to win prize with the head teacher. It seems to me like someone who's just desperate to get approval, because I don't think since he's been there that he's felt like someone that's he's been taken seriously. You only have to watch him before match days on Sky. When he talks to the press, he squirms. You know, he's constantly looking for approval and he's constantly looking to do his job the right way. It's not an easy position. I'm absolutely sure I don't envy him. But it does make me question the recruitment process of Bayern Munich to have looked at him and thought he was the right man to deal with that much scrutiny. And all you need to do is look at how Matthias Sammer handled that in comparison when he was at Bayern Munich, and you can see the contrast.
Yeah. Speaking of people who now need their superiors' approval, Sebastian Rudi appears to be at the doghouse at Schalke, because after the game, the sporting director for Schalke, Christian Heidel, said essentially he's not an 18-year-old, he's a 28-year-old, and he needs to show more passion and he just needs to play better.
He had a dreadful game, and I'm not surprised that Tedesco took him off after half an hour. I'm not. I mean, we did talk about McKennie being perhaps a little bit more loose in his positioning, but McKennie was also probably feeling pretty fed up with having someone as invisible as Sebastian Rudi next to me.
Didn't we laud this signing before when it happened?
We did, theoretically speaking, it looked like a fantastic move for Schalke. Yeah. You've got a team that was in need of a higher caliber of player. So you bring in a German national with World Cup experience who was touted by Bayern Munich. I thought,
who won a Confed Cup? I mean, come on.
He was great for Hoffenheim as well.
No, he was even better for Hoffenheim than he ever was for Bayern. So I thought this was a logical step up, and I think we've discussed Schalke's transfer policy quite a bit, and I've ranted and raised about it quite a bit. But I thought on paper, Sebastian Rudi is probably the only player that they've brought in who I thought potentially could be of the calibre they really want to be a top four team. The others really weren't, but he's definitely not showed it. He's not showed it in one single game that I can think of. So I'm not surprised at all. I'm not surprised that Christian Heidel has come out and said that. Although, I mean, as we've said, questions will need to be asked of Heidel as well. And we've talked about transfer issues.
Because they must, in the recruitment process, again, I don't want to sound like I'm just beating the same drum here, but...
Well, we are, because nothing's changed.
Yeah, but if you're going to buy Sebastian Rudi from Bayern Munich, surely part of the analysis there is he broken? Because how many players have gone to Bayern, having been good for their previous clubs, and been broken, and not been as good afterwards? And do we take, €15 million risk on buying him after a Bayern Munich move that obviously failed disastrously? And that seems to be, I'm not blaming putting all the blame on Christian Heidel's feet, but that has to be part of the analysis, because clearly, from the day he arrived at Schalke, he hasn't been right. He hasn't been good, which means it hasn't been something that's developed over time. It means it was like that from day one, which means when you signed him, you must have been aware of it. And if you weren't, then you didn't ask the right questions. And that's the problem.
Yeah, and if you were aware of that, then why were you not prepared to have the right support in place?
Yeah, exactly.
And have him looked after and coach and manage in the right way to get back to where he could be and be the player that Schalke do definitely need. I think it was a shame, because I think either by... Again, I'm not sure whether it was by luck or design. I actually thought Schalke stumbled for a few periods at least on a few decent attacking solutions. I mentioned Weston McKennie, I thought it was quite impressive going forward. And just as he was in the cup win over Dusseldorf, yeah, Ahmed Kutucu.
Yeah, scored in both of those games.
18 or 19.
18.
Yeah. A lad who's come, he's a local Gelsenkirchen lad. He's come through the academy there, so...
Turkish international, I believe, too.
Yeah, of Turkish heritage. Yeah. I'm not sure what path exactly he's taken in terms of what national team he wants to play for.
Yeah, sorry, that was irrelevant. I just wanted to prove that I knew that.
Impressive performance against Dusseldorf in the week, and he's done it again. Schalke's equaliser was reminiscent of the goals that Luka Bakio was putting past Bayern when Dusseldorf came back and drew 3-3 at the Allianz. Definitely shows that Bayern, as you mentioned before, with Liverpool coming up, definitely there for the taking with that high line, especially when they've not got the pace of Niklas Süle in that back four. But in terms of Schalke, I was impressed with Kutucu. It's the sort of thing I'd like to see. The only question is that, is this evidence that Domenico Tedesco has finally started to find the beginnings of a solution to Schalke's attacking problems? Can't be too much into it yet. Or is it just going to be another flash in the pan and we're going to continue to be frustrated by Schalke?
I mean, he did start him ahead of Oot, so there's some suggestion there that he feels like he's uncovered or discovered a gem. But he is short
Immediately starting kind of Pjanka as well, which hasn't been a given all
season
as well.
Although, short of attackers, right? Bergstrahler's out, Embolo's out. He's forced somewhat. Yeah. And the question is, Schalke's academy has a great history of producing players, right? We know that, but...
Not in recent years, then necessarily.
Not in recent years. And how many of these players can you realistically get? Not every player that you unturn is going to be the next...
Oh, it's
best
difficult,
thing.
And it has to be combined. So, it has to be combined with a proper transfer strategy. And I think it seems this season,
which it hasn't been this season,
so much been disappointing about Schalke on and off the pitch. But I think last time I was on here, I think I had a big rant about Schalke, how they've annoyed me this season just because they've let themselves down. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed in Schalke.
Hear that? You're on the naughty step, Schalke.
I'm now hoping that this is just the start. You know, come on, show something. You're a big enough club for it.
So before we move on, a quick programming note. We are going to be doing our first show away from home. We're going to Freiburg on the weekend of the 23rd. Freiburg will be playing Augsburg. We have already planned the trip down there. We do not know where we'd be going. So before we move on, one quick programming note. We are putting together a podcast later this month in Freiburg. We have got our tickets for the game. We got our tickets down to Freiburg. So all that's left really is to find a venue to report. So all that's left is to find a venue to record the podcast either before or after the game, and we will be all set. But we are going to be in Freiburg that weekend of the 23rd. The 23rd is the Saturday. That's Freiburg's game against Augsburg. So if any of you are in the area or want to come down and visit us, we'd very much appreciate it. But let's get back to the show. Felix was in Bremen this weekend. It was the 120th anniversary of the founding of the club, and they capped it off with a big win against, ironically, Augsburg. He caught up with members of the Tver fan club, and here is his conversation with them.
Right, so I'm here at the pub not far from the Weserstadion after the fan march. That was fun, as you might have heard. I'm here with a couple of very, very nice Werder Bremen fans. Enjoyable time, having wonderful beer. Okay, introduce yourself.
Yeah, I am Leonard, 28 years old, was born in Hamburg, which is not very common for a Bremen fan, but moved here early, and now I live in the Netherlands.
And?
Hi, Hi, I'm Kirsten. We're not speaking of my age. I was born and raised in Bremen, went away for a couple of years, and I'm back now.
Okay, very good. So today is obviously the club's birthday, 120 years loaded with history, both on and off the pitch. How do you sum up 120 years in two sentences?
It's been an interesting ride.
Uh-huh.
Let's keep it interesting.
Very good. Very good. In present day, we're expecting a big event today. Like, there's going to be, I assume, there's going to be a choreography and a big celebration during the game, the special tricots and everything. Let's get that out of the way. What are you expecting for today, both on and off the pitch?
So obviously the ultras are planning for months now a big choreography that is going to be up before the game starts. Mm-hmm. Then also during the game there will be celebrations. We also as a fan club have a banner that we'll display in for the start of the second half.
Mm-hmm.
On the pitch.
After that game in Dortmund on Tuesday, I think psychologically a lot of things happened in the team, good things, and I'm expecting to see that on the pitch today.
Very good. Speaking of that Dortmund game, any of you was there or were you home?
I had a ticket, but I was too busy, so I had to give it away. I kind of regret it, but it's okay.
Okay. What's your thoughts about that madness that went on there? Best birthday present ever?
Yeah, it was just crazy what was going on. I mean, starting so nicely and then scoring quite quickly was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Then they really contained Dortmund, and then coming back twice in overtime was just amazing. And so I think most of the Werder fans were already quite confident then when it went to penalties, because like, okay, they're kind of broken.
Yeah,
having the lead twice and then still having to go to penalties.
Okay.
And then we had the perfect
I was scared of the penalties.
Okay.
Because we've seen a couple of under 23 games when Eric Gülschlegel was still playing for it.
Okay.
And he's a solid goalkeeper, probably not.
He did well for them.
Well, probably not first league material, but a really solid goalkeeper, and he kills penalties.
Okay.
That's his thing. And I was like, and he had a really good run during the game, so I was like,
but you made it. So all in all, no complaints.
I mean, el pulpo.
Yeah.
I mean, Pablas is like, when he killed the first two, I was like, we're through.
Yeah.
They miss one, but I'm not seeing them miss two.
Yeah.
And also our penalties were really
critical.
Yeah. My weak one was Maxi Eggestein. I was like, okay, that's the weak one. And when he scored, I was like, we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Because it was
okay.
No.
Tell us a bit more about your fan club. What are your activities, about that special hobby that you have that I've just witnessed with my own eyes?
So first of all, the fan club is going to turn 4 soon, and it was founded by people who know each other quite some time already. And
what's it called?
It's called Twerda, so a mixture of Twerda and Twitter, because all of us are active on Twitter.
Okay.
And then basically, the first motivation to found it was that as a fan club, it's easier to get tickets for away matches. And I was like, okay, we're going to the games anyways. Why not start a fan club?
We form a fan club and get away tickets. That was all we wanted to do.
Fair enough. Away tickets is always a good excuse for anything, basically.
Yeah. And then
habit.
We were like a year old, and that was the season 2015-2016,
uh-huh,
where we nearly relegated. And after the Augsburg game, which was one of the last games, we noticed that in the stadium that the mood and everything was like down. It wasn't like people weren't going at the team, but everybody was like defeated. And we said, okay, if we're going out here, we're going out with a bang, and we want everybody to be loud. And that's when we started, like, Monday is the thing. Johanna came up with the idea we should start something on Twitter just to get people to go like be loud in the stadium next Saturday against Wolfsburg. And And when I think Stefan came up with Green White Wonderwall as a hashtag for it, and we started that on Monday, and that was a week where none of the whole club didn't speak to the press. So the press was a bit, well, what's the story this week? And I mean, we all have a certain amount of Twitter followers, so that thing got traction, and it got good traction. So I think Johanna and Stefan had like the first interview on Tuesday around noon, and then this whole thing went like viral.
Okay.
And so yeah.
And what's your pre-match habit? That was the...
Oh, that we just started. We had like, we went to Hanover in January.
Okay. First game of the second half of the season.
Second half of the season. And I had highlighter with me because I like makeup. And highlighter. I said, everybody gets highlighter today because today is a good day. I'm not coughing. And so everybody got highlighters and we won. So.
Works very well with Lennart's beard, by the way.
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet today, but...
It's free, it's vegan, it's politically completely correct. And we went like... And, well, we didn't wear a highlighter against Frankfurt.
And Nuremberg.
And Nuremberg. So...
We only drew, so...
We're thinking highlighter may have something to do with winning. So now we're all wearing highlighter again, looking very fly.
Mm-hmm. That's North Germany for you in one story right there. Brilliant stuff. So let's one word about the future of the club. What are you expecting? What do you want to see the club doing or the way that you see the club going in the future? Or what would you wish the club for the future?
So to wish the club, it's just stay as exciting as you are. Mm-hmm. Don't forget where you come from, but it's really getting talent from the youth team more into the club. Playing attractive football is what we all love and what the club is doing more and more now. We hope that they continue.
And what about off the pitch? The club's activities off the pitch?
I think on and off the pitch, in both ways. We're at the current time, we're at a very good way. So there's social responsibility and...
Political responsibility.
Yeah.
Political responsibility.
President.
And how the whole club is involved in the city of Bremen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, on the pitch as well, how we develop young players. That's the core of our group. That's the core of what Werder Bremen is. And I wish for the future that we stay true to this core, that we are a club with the city.
Mm-hmm.
And
brilliant.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, that's been a brilliant conversation. Thank you, Tverda people. And yeah, let's see how the game goes.
So I made it in. It's slightly rainy, but nothing too difficult. It's relatively okay. There's a choreography prepared. You can see that something big is going to happen here. As you can hear, the Klatsch Pappe nonsense has made its entrance to football, which I think is not very good. It sounds horrible. I think we should leave this nonsense to handball, but that's just me. But it's party atmosphere here in Bremen. Looking forward to the game, looking forward to the choreography. It seems like something really impressive is going to happen. So, let's see. What a party! 3-0, not even 30 minutes in, absolutely mental. The place is just buzzing, incredible atmosphere.
Right, so it's done.
fantastic atmosphere, great game. Bremen were by far the better team. Attacking football, fun football, high pressing, everything you could expect. Defensive-wise, they were a bit cranky, but Pavlenka is so good that it doesn't really matter. I mean, even when he makes these slight mistakes, it seems like he's always under control, which is very, very impressive. I genuinely think he's one of the 2-3 best goalkeepers this league has to offer. All in all, enjoyable experience. Loads of celebrations for Bremen's 120th birthday. The choreography was incredible. Lots of banners in celebration of Bremen's current state. Lots of celebrations of Bremen's stance on, for instance, LGBT rights and stuff like that. It was brilliant to see. It was lots of fun to be here. And now people are sort of making their way home. So all in all, enjoyable day had by all. And yeah, I'm heading home too. So hope you enjoyed. And till next time, bis zum nächsten Mal.
That was Felix Tomsøt in Bremen. Remember, you can follow him on Twitter at ftomsøt. And you can follow the Tverda fan club at WFC Tverda. That'll do it for this week's edition of Tribuna Weekly. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you have the opportunity, please leave us a friendly review. You can also like our Tribuna Podcast Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Tribuna Podcast. Matt Ford is on Twitter at Matt_4D. Jonathan Harding at JohnBlog66, 2 G's and 2 6's. And I'm at Davis_Fenoptrop. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.